From the Ladvox Studios in Seattle, Washington, and coast to coast and around the world, this is Web Talk Radio.
Thank you for listening today. We are the Web Talk Guys at WebTalkGuys.com or WebTalkRadio.com. And my name is Rob Greenlee, and I'm joined by Dana Greenlee, my co-host. The relationship between music and the internet is constantly evolving. Throw in Apple computers, iTunes, recent announcements here of supporting Windows access to the iTunes, and the relaunch of paid Napster 2.0, and you begin to wonder if there is an emerging utopian vision for the music industry. It's about time. Perhaps more surprises may be coming to Apple, according to Web Talk Radio resident pundit Mitch Radcliffe, who's back on the show with us this week. He is an A-list blogger, and he's going to join us in the studio to voice his opinion about what is next for Apple.
How much do you want to bet that Apple will become a music label someday? Now, there's one caveat. That is, every time Apple comes close to the music business, they get sued by Apple Corps, which is the Beatles record label. And they do have a consent agreement between the two companies that says Apple will stay out of the music industry.
Don't make me wait. That's the message Andy King hears over and over again from website surfers. His mission is to mitigate the slow loading blues. His solution, website optimization. Andy King is president of WebsiteOptimization.com and author of Speed Up Your Site. He's also the founder of WebReference.com, a very popular site, and JavaScript.com, and he knows the value of a fast-loading website. It's tied in with, among other things, having access to the internet via broadband like DSL and cable. He'll join us to talk about his latest broadband report and secrets of speeding up your site.
Slow download times are one of the most popular, if not the most popular, complaints of people surfing the internet. You know, they talk about pop-up ads, we talk about spam, but really ask people hate to wait for websites. The nice thing about this is it's kind of a win-win. You save money on bandwidth when you optimize your site for speed, and you also make more money because the people are clicking through, you're getting more impressions, your conversion rate also goes up too.
It's time for a brief summary of, well, what we liked on the web this week.
Yeah, there's a lot of fascinating news, all kind of swirling around Microsoft courting Google for a possible takeover. And we've talked about this on the show before, but it seems like it's starting to have some legitimacy. It's coming out in places like the New York Times are looking at, possibly acquired by Microsoft. Microsoft's looking for search technology, and there's no bigger player, and Microsoft's got a big pot of money up there. So
the Google execs are basically sitting in their boardroom weighing the options of public offering, making a lot of money, selling out, making a lot of money.
Yeah, they've got all the choices that a person could want.
I think the only thing they're not going to do is just stay Google and private.
I think there's a chance of that for a little while here, but I think they're going to go either way. They're either going to sell to a company like Microsoft, which I don't think is really likely, but I think what is likely is an IPO. And if they go IPO, they're going to get rich either way.
Speaking of Microsoft, they're denying plans that they're going to do is to become sort of the paid search engine industry, but yet they've beefed up their employees in that area by about 200 people.
Well, I think this statement that they're denying doing paid search is only because they're currently getting those services provided to them right now. But once they get the technology built, there's a very good chance that they would do that because there's a lot of money to be made there. They've, just like Dana said, they've added about 200 people to their Microsoft network search area, and they've identified it as one of their key businesses, and that usually means some investment and getting into all aspects of making money in that area. So I would really keep an eye on this potential between Microsoft and Google.
So, Rob, what's more important, broadband DSL or broadband cable? Who's winning that war? Or is it the 14.4K modems out there?
That's right. Well, certainly broadband is growing in adoption. It's really surging at this point, and we're going to speak more about it later in the show. But Comcast is the number one largest cable provider, and they've added about 472,000 new subscribers for the quarter ending September 30th. That's a 39% increase.
That's how we get ours from home, is Comcast.
Yeah, and Cox Communications has jumped their subscribers about 38% versus last year as well. The fascinating thing is the SPC company that provides DSL service has added 365,000 subscribers, which is a 60% increase over last year. So things are really looking up for cable and high-speed access.
And just in case you're not one of the adopters of broadband, there's a little price war going on. DSL's kind of slashing their prices, so you can get it between $26.99 and about $30 a month. And yeah, cable's still hanging around $45 to $55 a month. Mm-hmm. Time to get out that digital mailbag.
Yeah.
We've got about three of them to read today, picking different ones. Looks like Andy K. wrote us. Andy said he just came across our website and our talk radio show and, quote, "I've become an avid listener." Ooh, thanks, Andy. Andy wants to know what we use as our email client and web browser. Well, it's a little personal, Andy.
Yeah.
No. We can tell him.
We don't ever talk about those kind of things, do we, Dana?
We're not anything unusual. No, we're not big, so IE. Who isn't using IE?
I use Outlook and I use IE6. Yeah. I've used Opera and I've used Mozilla, so I've tried all the browsers out there, but it's just easier just to use the IE at this point.
And can I just say something? Neoplanet. I love Neoplanet.
That's Neoplanet was a great browser.
And it stills around. Yeah. And I remember they were the first one I had for the longest time, and you could fit it on a floppy and carry it around. You probably still can.
Well, it's still IE, so they just put a different wrapper on it.
It's all right.
Yeah.
I never knew that. Okay. We have another email there. Rob, why don't you read it?
We heard from Tavish Baker, actually wrote us, and he said, "Wow, I had no idea this show existed for so long, and I found it about a week ago, and I've recently fallen in love with internet radio." He's using it as a source to get info on everything that he has an interest in. I think he's finding it rather amazing, and it's true. There's a lot of content out there. And he says, "Thank you very much for including an MP3 download of your show. I actually listen to it on my iPod while I'm working out at the gym." Well, that's terrific.
Yeah. All right. I pulled one out from Nick Gassman. Nick is an e-commerce manager for British Airways. Great to have someone from England listening. Actually, we have a lot of people from England listening. Mm-hmm. And Nick wanted me to point out he's not the e-commerce manager. He's one of a team. Nick says, "I caught up with the time shifting episode, which was on last week's show. Mitch Radcliffe, who's going to speak in a few minutes, talked a lot about time shifting, but Nick kind of took exception. He says he found the content a bit lightweight." Well, whenever Mitch comes in, he's very profound, but he can also be extremely silly.
Yeah.
And we just had to breeze through a lot of the stuff. But Nick says, after hearing about ways to record web radio and then listen to it at your leisure, that's what time shifting is. He says how this could cause problems for the advertisers, and we kind of just dropped it after that. But
he ran out of time.
He has some comments of his own, and I think we should have – well, actually, I have asked Nick to be on our show sometime in the future because of his work with British Airways, but he is quite a brain on him about technology.
Yeah, he's got some terrific ideas.
He says probably the first mass market time shifting was when the gramophone record came out and people could listen to concerts without actually having to go to the theater. That's absolutely
true. Yeah, that's true. That's a first example.
And then cassette tapes and VHS allowed people to tape their own live concerts, so that was time shifting. And then, of course, we all know TiVo, and this is still Nick talking, saying that TiVo could even skip through those commercials, which was, again, what we talked about in time shifting. Mm-hmm. And then for online content, he brought us right up to date. Your pre-recorded MP3 files allow people to listen at their leisure. He says, "I really don't understand why more sites don't do that. They only provide streaming content. My guess is that it's because they don't get it." So by default, Nick's saying, "We get it."
Well, I think,
thank you.
Yeah, I think they have control issues. They want to control the distribution of that music. So that's the big reason.
Yeah, that's probably true. He hypothesized that maybe it's just more expensive, or they think, or time-consuming. Of course, we know what that's not. And a lot of people seem to have the saying MP3 equals illegal. And Nick says maybe they're afraid they're somehow going to be illegal having it. I don't know. So good try, but he has some great suggestions, Rob. Why don't you run through a few of them?
Well, yeah, he actually recommended a program called XRipper, and it's at www.sonetics.net/software/xripper.html.
Wow.
And yeah, I know that's a mouthful. We'll see if we can put a link onto our website to that. But what this does is it enables you to record anything that goes through your sound card on your PC. So I guess you can get your hands on just about anything with this. You can record streaming audio and listen at your leisure on any device. And I also have a couple of things that I want to recommend as well as far as software out there to capture streaming as well. And one is WMRecorder.com. And what this one does is records Windows media files, primarily videos. And you can record it right off of the Windows Media Player. And then another one is Replay Radio. And I think we've mentioned this on the show in the past.
Replay-radio.
Yeah, replay-radio.com. And what this one does is records radio shows either off your PC or off of a stereo that you may have plugged into your PC.
But Nick had another good one. Why don't you share that?
Yeah, he was talking about it's kind of a creative idea, and we've actually done it on our show before, but it's called Text Aloud. And what this is a program that allows you to cut text and paste it into this little converter that converts the text into like an MP3 file that you can synchronize with your pocket PC or whatever and listen to. And you can do it with news sites, or you can do it with emails, or even company information. So if you don't have time to read something, you just create a little audio file, and it creates like a little synthetic voice, though, so you got to get used to that.
And Nick, being British, of course, he has to put it his two cents. He says, he finds it surprisingly realistic to hear this, you know, generated voice. He says, from my perspective, just a little annoyingly American. I understand. I wish I could speak British. He says,
they should make a British-sounding synthesized voice, right?
But I think it's ingenious right how Nick does it. He actually, you know, pastes in the news, and he goes and he listens to it basically as he drives to work. That's really efficient, Nick.
It's called channel shifting is what he calls it.
Before we run out of time, we want to thank some supporters of Web Talk Radio.
Compass Communications, a network and server colocation provider up in the Seattle area at ccom.net. And we also want to thank MailWiper, who has got a terrific spam filtering software program that supports the WebTalk guys. And they are at MailWiper.com as well as PayByCheck.com, which supplies a terrific e-commerce payment method via a checking account for e-commerce websites. So go to PayByCheck.com.
And Rob, two new sponsors this week I want to thank. Mobile phone review site called mobile-phones-review.co.uk. You can read consumer reviews on the latest mobile phones and cell phones, find out what other people are thinking. And also, support comes from Best of the Web at botw.com. They're an internet web directory and a great place that you can submit your site URL if you want to get it in a directory.
And links to both those sites are right up on our front page, so go check them out.
Web Talk Radio's resident pundit, Mitch Radcliffe, just stepped into the room, jocking up to the microphone to get all fired up over Apple and iTunes and the emerging utopian vision for the music industry.
Stay connected. This is Web Talk Guys Radio. Hi, this is Rob Greenlee of Web Talk Guys Radio. I have a tip for you that will cut your inbox spam down to zero, guaranteed. The solution is a very powerful software plugin I've come across called MailWiper, and it cleaned my inbox of all my hundreds of unwanted emails I get every day, and continues to do so every day, 7 days a week. MailWiper currently works with Outlook and Outlook Express from Microsoft and supports multiple email accounts. Definitely stop deleting your emails and wearing out your finger. Do your part to fight spam. MailWiper can be downloaded and installed in seconds and set up within a half an hour. There are no monthly or annual fees ever. Get your life back. I certainly did. Go to MailWiper.com now and save over 40% off the regular $49.95 price. You actually can get the software for $29.95 if you order it right off of the website at MailWiper.com. MailWiper comes with a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee and free technical support. So go to MailWiper.com and get those savings, and it's only
$29.95. Oh! And now, the Web Talk Guys, with your host, Rob Greenlee.
You're back with Web Talk Guys Radio at WebTalkRadio.com, and my name is Rob Greenlee, and I've got Web Girl Dana, or formerly Web Girl Dana, just Dana in here.
And to my left, our favorite commentary pundit, that would be Mitch Radcliffe, a very respected journalist in the world of blogging and all kinds of things. Mitch is at radcliffe.com, and that's spelled RATCLIFFE.com.
We're kind of making this a habit now.
That's what I was going to say. You seem to be in here all the time now.
I just hang around.
Oh, well, you just walk in whenever you feel like it now, mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah,
okay.
You know, because I've been fascinated by the fact that Dana is no longer Web Girl Dana.
Oh.
I see it as a new phase of maturity in Dana's life. And so I come over and I try to appreciate that you have made this progress in your life. Congratulations.
Mitch is a girl's best friend in every way. Thank you, Mitch.
Do you think it's a good thing that we dropped the guys thing?
I feel like
the,
Oprah, you know.
Off of the name of...
You really have struggled with so much.
Oh, and you kind of have that look, too. Mm-hmm.
You go.
She's come so far.
She has.
In such a short period of
time. Once a web girl, now just a woman.
Yes.
We're going to be talking a bit about music. There's so much happening online, so much shifting, Napster and Apple. What's going on, Mitch?
Time shifting of music, right?
Well, I think, last time we talked about time shifting of audio stuff, but music in general, I mean, we're finally seeing the beginning of the really amazing new market for music. And the evidence in iTunes and the fact that Napster's coming back and various downloading music services are out there says an awful lot about how we're going to be choosing what we listen to and not having to take the whole album but take the pieces we like.
Why are we seeing this all of a sudden now? It seemed like that this need for people getting singles and being able to buy individual tracks is something that's been wanted by, the online customer, kids all over the world. Why all of a sudden now? I mean, are the record labels finally recognizing that they need to accept this and this is where it's
going?
Yeah,
they are. They're finally recognizing. They finally have deal terms with the various distributors that make it reasonable for them to do it. The other thing is that the recording industry has managed to hate their consumers almost as much as they hate their artists. And having finally overcome the fact that they – we're going to destroy their industry, they have had to embrace this.
Well, it was either they do what they did or they felt like their industry was going to be destroyed because it was going to get so out of control and they were going to lose so much money that all those companies were going to go out of business.
No, there's a point where, it would have been easy for artists to say, screw it. We'll just go around these guys.
Yeah, and that's probably where it was going.
Yeah. Well, look at Phish. I mean, in the videos and selling their own recordings. And the Dead did it for years with the cassette tapes. So I think that's the Grateful Dead for you kids out there. There's just a point where there's enough pain for the consumer that it becomes easier to do something else.
Well, it's also there's enough pain for the record labels to do something else too, it seems like. I mean, they resisted and fought.
Well, we
the
did
whole
something
process.
Else. The consumers did something else. We started file sharing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. We voted by trading files, and that forced them into making a change.
They still hate us, though, right?
Yeah, I think they do.
Oh, they
hate consumers.
They
I get letters
their
all the time from the RIA. We hate you.
I'm going to sue you. And 5-year-old children.
That's right. Suing that 12-year-old was such a coup.
Yeah, takes a lot of guts to do that, doesn't it?
It does. But I think it's just really impressive what particularly Apple has done to start this market, because they just went ahead, launched iTunes, did it with their little tiny market share, where the Mac is irrelevant. But the fact is, they started selling a whole lot of music,
and now it's available to even Windows.
Now it's on PCs. Mm-hmm. They announced that a couple of weeks ago, and it's a. It's a whole new world, and as a result, you've seen, Napster will be back. Napster was acquired by Roxio, which makes CD burning software and other stuff, and you can obviously imagine what you do with a CD burning software, Napster. You make your own CDs. You do lots of stuff, and Chris Gorog, who runs Napster, is Roxio, is planning on making that a channel for a wide range of content, not just music.
Mm-hmm. Is Sean Fanning having anything to do with
Sean is a consultant to the company.
Okay. He gets a check.
So they can say, Sean's with us.
Yeah.
Certainly, this is good for the overall music industry, but it's especially good for the music consumer, I would think, having these new sites launch. Because what it creates is a market situation where these sites are competitive, and that's going to drive the cost per song down, I would think.
I think you're right. And, you look at what Apple and Pepsi are doing now. They're giving away 100 million songs to get people to try iTunes.
That's phenomenal.
And so now there's 100 million free songs out there. Of course, not all of them will be downloaded, but 100 million free songs that the industry actually is saying, yes, give them away.
Free file sharing still live,
right?
That's a
sea change. That's a very big change. And, it's also incredibly ironic that Steve Jobs, who used the line, do you want to sell sugared water for the rest of your life, to John Sculley to get him to leave Pepsi and come to Apple, is now, of course, selling sugared water and music.
Be careful what you say, right? Yes.
You know, Mitch has a very long memory. He remembers these ironies and brings them up.
So, yeah, I think the iTunes is, I mean, that's the one I use. I've tried the other ones. I've talked to Roxio about what Napster's going to do. I just have found the integration as a Mac person great, and my iPod just rocks. There's still a big step to happen, and that is the different file formats and being able to play all of the different file formats on a single device that's portable mm-hmm. when you're away from your computer, or even to be able to move between different libraries of content that you might have on your computer. It's like if I bought it from a different store, it doesn't work with the other stuff. I mean, you wouldn't go to the grocery store and buy onions that wouldn't cook if you mixed them with carrots from a different store.
Well, and what you're really talking about here is digital rights management and the impact of different formats on that distribution network. And that was a big topic of the Streaming Media Conference I was at. And there seems to be a lot of conflict right now within the industry of what format to use, what DRM solution is the best solution to control the use, and how restrictive is fair use going to be on the consumer out there? How many times can you play that song? How many devices can you transfer it to? And under what format? And can those formats be decoded into WAV files? I mean, there's just so many issues that are still yet to be resolved, I think, in some ways.
Yeah, and it's a long process of standardization. Just as, different types of recording formats have come out in the past. And, you had the tube recordings, and then you had the platter recordings, and they didn't work on the same player, obviously.
Yeah, and I think in reality, fair use is going to be something that's going to be challenged. I just don't see any way around it. These record labels have to figure out some way, or even radio shows have to restrict the amount of access to this and the amount of transferability in order to control.
You're just one of those Nazi content owners is what you are.
If that's the purpose of DRM, then there's going to have to be some limits, and there's going to be some people that are going to be pissed off.
You can't take a business approach to this that says that your customer is the enemy.
Well, that's exactly what's happened here. I totally agree.
Even though all this good stuff is happening, we got a long, long
way to go. We're just at the beginning of it, and we're going to face a lot of legal challenges, I'm sure, and the Congress is going to have to deal with it, and the RIAA is going to be continuing to push their agenda.
Well, I can say that the last Warren Zevon album is very good, and it's available on iTunes now. So that was my last download.
Plus, it's also going to give an opportunity to a lot of independent artists that never got exposure because they didn't get the package deals with the big record labels.
How much do you want to bet that Apple will become a music label someday? I would put
$1,000.
You've
actually said this before.
I put $1,000 down on this, that Apple will get into the music business. Now, there's one caveat. That is, every time Apple comes close to the music business, they get sued by Apple Corps, which is the Beatles record label. And they do have a restraining order or a consent agreement between the two companies that says Apple will stay out of the music industry.
Just because of the name share.
Yeah, and the fact that the logos look pretty similar. I mean, Apple just has – computer only has a bite out of what was an Apple on an album.
All you have to do is name the record label something about Mac, Mac Music or something.
Right. Well,
money talks.
Yeah.
I mean, if they can come to a financial agreement.
I don't think that Ringo and Sir Paul would say no to a handsome –
No, that's right.
Royalty.
And is Apple going to be able to continue their dominance in this in the face of their platform being such a small percentage of the market, though?
Well, considering the fact that in the first 3.5 days after they introduced iTunes for the PC, I don't think it's really a matter of their platform, the Macintosh platform being a small section of the market. It's how do they get this onto as many different computers as possible, and they seem to be making with that Pepsi deal. A lot of headway. Mm-hmm.
But they're going over to the dark side, aren't they?
No. I like their slogan that hell froze over when they introduced it. But but Steve and Bill have been getting along for a long time, so what the hell. I think Apple is poised to do much larger things than people would have imagined possible, and it's always because of the bold and vaguely psychotic behavior of Steve Jobs. I mean, he takes these risks when other people won't.
Well, and I totally hope that Apple is able to keep growing and keep expanding their base, because competition to the PC is a good thing. I mean, that's what keeps Microsoft on their toes. And
those big old fat dinosaur toes.
Toes, yes. And actually, I hope that they get even more market share than they have now. I mean, we had a guest on the show last week that talked about the whole Apple culture and how it appeals to a different customer base than the PC does. And
it's the Porsche of the industry.
Yes, it is. And that's okay.
Mm-hmm. And well, it's becoming more like the consumer market that, you know, we have Porsches and there's BMWs, which aren't really that good a car, but everybody buys them because they're prestigious. And then, you know, you've got General Motors. Microsoft is General Motors. Porsche is Apple in this case.
So go visit iTunes.com if you want to see what Mitch is talking about and download their Windows application and
yeah, I guess
check it out.
Probably open Pepsi's a lot too these days.
That's right. Well, Mitch,
go for that sugar water.
Well, Mitch, thanks again for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
Stay plugged in because up next, Andy King on how you can speed up your website and just what about that broadband adoption here in the U.S. You're listening to Web Talk Guys Radio.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea. Have you ever wanted to say the news, see the news, and tell the news the way you experienced it, not rely on the big media, the guy with a camera to come out and tell it for you? Well, check out correspondences.org. It's the first civic journalism site for America. We just ask you to join the staff and begin contributing. We'll set you up with an account. It's simple, it's easy, and more importantly, it's free. We want people, citizens, talking about their problems and the solutions they have for them. So check out correspondences.org. That's www.correspondences.org. Correspondences. News for the people, by the people.
Welcome back to the Web Talk Guys World Radio Show, and my name is Rob Greenlee, and that's Dana on the other mic.
Hey, thanks, Rob. In U.S. homes, internet access via broadband like DSL and cable has reached 40%. Now, that's a great milestone. That's all nice, but it still leaves 60% of U.S. homes with narrowband connections. That's something like 56K or less.
Yeah, that's a lot of dial-up connections that people are still accessing the net on, and that makes it all the more crucial for our next guest to get his message out. And his message is, don't make me wait. Andy King hears that statement quite often from website surfers as president of WebsiteOptimization.com and founder of WebReference.com, one of the most popular developer sites on the internet, and JavaScript.com. And he's compiled his years of good advice into his new book called Speed Up Your Site, Website Optimization. Andy also publishes the Bandwidth Report, a monthly roundup of broadband connectivity. And Andy's with us right now to talk about his broadband report and secrets to speeding up your website. Andy, thanks for joining us on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've released your October 2003 bandwidth report, and it's certainly showing some tremendous numbers when it as it relates to people using broadband in the United States. I guess it's breaking like 40%. What's your thoughts on all that?
I think it's great. I think it's an important time because we just broke 40% for the first time in the U.S. at least. So it shows that broadband is really making headway.
Yeah, it seems to be really growing fast. I know I saw the growth chart, and it seems like we're going to be up, 70% just in a year or so?
Oh, you're thinking about 70 already. I'm really looking at 50.
Well, I'm excited about what's happening. So
yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, looking at the growth chart, I kind of do some extrapolation. I'm an engineer, so I like doing that kind of thing. And if you look at it, let's see, maybe July, August, summer 2005, we should be at 70%. That's assuming that we're going at the same rate of growth.
Yeah, exactly.
We should be, I think it's safe to say next summer we'll break 50%. This coming summer,
okay,
we'll break 50%. It's around June or July. What I found looking at other countries, too, is that there seems to be a saturation level.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you about that.
Korea, they say they're approaching that. They're, you know, depending on who you talk to, they're around 70%.
Oh, they are, really?
Yeah. Again, depending on who you talk to. But they say they're kind of reaching a saturation level at that point because there's certain folks in, you know, outlying rural areas that
they just aren't going to pick it up. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
can't really get hooked up unless they get a, you know, like a satellite dish or something like that.
Certainly, the whole computing you know, all the companies making computers are trying to come up with a good reason for people to get broadband. There's no question about it. It's like video and multimedia and things like that. But speaking of any kind of holdup in that growth and that acceleration, what other things do you see might hold up the adoption of broadband?
I think the main thing is price and also complexity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in our area, the price keeps going down, which is good, but it's kind of a teaser price.
Mm-hmm.
They'll give it to you for 6 months, and then they'll bump it up to the $49.95. And that's a good chunk of change. Also, some folks are having trouble hooking up. Cable seems to be much simpler. I think that's why it has twice the penetration in the U.S. than DSL does.
Oh,
so I think the simpler they can make it, the faster it's going to propagate.
Andy, you mentioned a moment ago the fact that people in rural areas probably have been wanting to, you know, do it, but it's just not available to them. Is there a point when whoever's the provider, Comcast or whoever's the provider, will be in every area so that the option is available?
Gosh, that's a good question. I'm not sure they're going to be everywhere. I don't think you'll be able to get in the bottom of Death Valley anytime soon.
Well,
but I think what they're doing is they're focusing on where they can get the most bang for your buck. So, you know, the 2.5 miles for DSL, and it's really a last mile problem.
Yeah.
But we actually have a cottage up in Canada, and the only way to get broadband there is to get a satellite dish.
Well, talk a little bit about that. How is that as an option for people, and is it exponentially expensive?
Actually, the price keeps going down. The satellite dishes, you can get fairly good download speeds. Upload speeds are a different story.
Yeah.
But again, the best option is to have a wire directly into your home.
Certainly, wireless is a big frontier opportunity for broadband as we look into the future. Do you see that starting to pick up steam, or do you see that, especially within the United States, that we're going to turn into almost like a backwater of wireless broadband compared to the rest of the world?
Yeah, overseas, they're definitely ahead of us there. But, if Starbucks and McDonald's have their way, we'll have wireless everywhere, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you actually have on your site a lot of information about, well, you do a world tour. So why don't you talk a little bit about, as you alluded to, the world sort of picking up on broadband maybe a little bit faster than the U.S.?
That's right. If you go to the Pacific Rim, Korea, Hong Kong, they actually have much higher penetration rates than we do. And you can, you know, talk about the reasons for that. But and Canada is well ahead of us, too. They were at 60% a few months ago, so I'm sure they're above that now. Taiwan's up there, too, Denmark, Belgium. I'm looking at the September bandwidth report. I put up a chart there from the ITU.
Mm-hmm.
Iceland is even ahead of us, believe it or not.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, well, you know, what else is there to do up there, right? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that's true. Well, why do you think all these other countries are adopting it faster than we are? Is it a content issue, do you think, or is it just people just don't feel that they need it, or is it a cost issue?
I think it's a combination of things. I think what's happening, some countries realize that it's really a strategic advantage to do this. So they've gotten a bit of a head start on us.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've relaxed some government regulations. They've done some subsidies. It's kind of a combination of things. And also, if you look at the other countries, DSL, it's kind of flipped. Here, it's, you know, cable has twice the penetration of DSL. So if you go to Korea, it's, you know, it's DSL. That's how they get connected.
Mm-hmm.
So they've made it simpler to connect. So I think it's a combination of things. I don't think you can point to just one single factor.
Sure. Well, certainly 56K modems are still popular with, 49.7%. So most people are getting online right now through a dial-up connection.
That's right. Yeah. If you add all up the modems, it's about 60%.
Yeah.
In the U.S. at least.
Yeah, and if you look out into the future here, very quickly that number is going to get down to 50% and 40% and 30%, and most people are going to be on with broadband. But I guess there's going to be a few stragglers, it seems like, that are going to hang on to those 33K modems. And there actually was at 3% or at 14.4 still.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? People are still out with a 14.4 modem. I mean, I still have some in the drawer. People are welcome to buy them from me, but
That's an obvious giveaway, right?
Yeah. I make a nice bookmark or something. But some folks don't have much of a choice. Maybe they can't upgrade, or maybe they're in a school where there's some donated computers.
Yeah.
Maybe they're using a wireless phone that gets 9,600 baud.
Yeah, that's true.
You really have to, you know, kind of design for the worst-case scenario, I think.
Yeah.
That brings up something I've been thinking about, and you actually, we're going to talk a little bit more soon about your book, Speed Up Your Site, but a lot of web designers listen to the show, and, you have to still consider, obviously, building for a slower speed, the lowest common denominator, in a sense. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. That's actually why I did the bandwidth report, because there was so much kind of data out there. I didn't see any really good numbers or charts.
Yeah.
So I just went ahead and published it to show people, no, not everybody's on broadband, at least in the U.S.
Yeah, it certainly would be a wonderful thing if everybody was, but it's going to take a few years for everybody to really, really get on board with broadband. Well, let's talk a little bit about workplace broadband as well. It seems like that is really showing strong numbers, too, at almost 73%.
Right, yeah, they're in the U.S., again, 73%
are
on broadband,
mm-hmm.
nearly 73%, 27.2 on 56K or less. And that makes sense. But people want a T1 at work. People want a high-speed LAN at work.
Yeah.
But, again, not everybody browses Amazon or eBay from work.
Yeah, that is true. And if they do,
maybe they'll get in trouble. And
well,
sure.
That's some of the things that are starting to be talked about, too, is our employers going to cut off access to the web because it's so distracting. And you know, I think the whole issue with the email spam is having an impact on all these things, too. What's your thought on all that?
I think it's good to focus on work when you're at work and, maybe do the things in the off hours. The email problem is a big problem. I just did a little report on that in the newsletter I published for Web Reference. And I read that in May, 55% of all email is spam.
I believe it. If you look at my inbox, it's probably higher than that.
I know. You don't want to look at my inbox. I get a lot of. It seems like the older your email, the more spam you get.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So keep changing your email address all the time.
That's right.
Right.
Or just get like a Hotmail account and then give that one out, kind of thing.
And realistically, what is your best advice for people who? Is it a spam filter? Is it not passing out your email address? If you have a website, don't conventionally put it up as a text link. What do you advise people?
Well, that's a good all the common sense options. Don't post a Usenet with the email. You don't want to get a lot of spam on. Probably is the biggest one. Use a kind of a throwaway email, a Hotmail account or something, mm-hmm. for when sites ask for your email address.
Yeah,
and just have a trusted few that you send out the good email to. You can also use. There's a lot of kind of spam assassin, the spam challenge spam methods work really well. You can have whitelists or blacklists. And filters, I'm actually doing this for my mother. She's getting all this, porn spam, and she doesn't like that stuff.
We have to protect our mothers.
Exactly.
I'm starting to filter it out. She goes, can we, so she comes up with a list of words, and I'll put the filters in, and so we're kind of chipping away at it.
How does it really feel to hold a list in your hand that your mother wrote with all those bad words in
it? It feels very strange. These spammers are putting us webmasters through a lot of stress here.
Yeah, they are.
Ideally, we'd get, a program to do it automatically, but there's only so much you can do automatically.
Well, let's talk about your book, Speed Up Your Site, Website Optimization, and kind of give us your thoughts on why do you think it's important for webmasters to go through the process of making their site optimized for download? And what are some of the benefits of that?
It kind of tied in with the bandwidth report, too. No matter what your bandwidth, people are willing to wait a certain amount before they'll get frustrated, they'll get distracted, and they'll want to go do something else. So really, and if people hate to wait, I guess is the... To boil it down. So I figured rather than complaining to people about it, I'd do something concrete about it, so I wrote this book. And my background as an engineer is in optimization of structures, and I use finite element analysis, so it's kind of a natural extension to apply that kind of efficiency to the web. So I started to do that to my own site, and I started writing articles and web reference at the site that I ran before I did this. And it just kind of came around, and I thought, hey, might as well write a book about it. I hadn't seen any other books about optimizing the content that we send out on our website.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I'd go ahead and write it, and the response has been great. The first part of the book talks about the psychology, kind of creates a need. You can show that part to your boss if the boss doesn't believe it. And it kind of summarizes all the research that's out there that talks about if you look at the surveys, there's a number of surveys people have taken, including, you know, Jacob Nielsen, everybody's heard of him, that show that slow download times are one of the most popular, if not the most popular, complaint of people surfing the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they talk about pop-up ads, we talk about spam, but really ask people hate to wait for websites.
Yeah,
and it really doesn't matter what your bandwidth is. You don't want to wait.
Yeah.
And it depends on, you know, age. There's a number of factors, how complex you perceive the transaction, that kind of thing. But it ranges from about 8 to 10 seconds is kind of the consensus that I got from looking at all the surveys and the research. After about 8 to 10 seconds, people start to, you know, their eyes glaze over and they start thinking about other things.
Yeah.
Short attention spans.
Short,
right?
Attention spans, you,
yeah,
know. And it has to do, if you want to know why, I talk about that in the book, it has to do with how our short-term memory works. And, you know, we kind of make plans for the next thing. And you actually get into a flow as you're going through the web. You start to kind of, if you're working on a fast set of pages, fast set of sites, you kind of get into a rhythm. And if you run into a slow site, say, it really kind of disrupts your train of thought. It disrupts your rhythm. And so it's really distracting.
You know, I've never thought of it that way. That's the psychology behind it. And you're right. When you start clicking around and you've got a rhythm going, you just want to start clicking reload or something, anything to help it download faster. Of course,
exactly.
That makes it,
yeah,
worse.
Wouldn't it be nice if there was a button that you could just click speed up your site and it would automatically happen?
Super speed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it seems like as bandwidth, though, grows, I mean, once we get to 50, 60, 70% out there, I would think that these are going to become a little bit less important. But there's another angle to this, too, as well, is that bandwidth costs money, too. So
bandwidth definitely costs money. So you say the nice thing about this is it's kind of a win-win. You save money on bandwidth when you optimize your site for speed, and you also make more money because people are...
Yeah.
The people are clicking through. You're getting more impressions. Your conversion rate also goes up too.
Now there's a long laundry list, I'm sure, of things that are bad for your site. You know, if you want to have a killer website, you got to watch those flash things and the tables and the images. But what do you think? Just that pops into your head, probably the most egregious, but maybe easily fixed error a webmaster could make to just make it a little bit faster.
Oh boy, I would say minimize the number of HTTP requests, which is, you know, the embedded objects, the JavaScript, the CSS, the images, the flash files, the shockwave.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you go back and forth, that HTTP requests are just a request to the server.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you go back and forth, you're not really sure how long that's going to take.
Yeah.
Because the path is indeterminate, that, you know, a backhoe could sever a line in New Jersey somewhere, and you don't know what's going to happen. So that in itself, right there, if you could reduce it, and I've seen some pages with 50, 100 HTTP requests, that's just way too much.
So an example of that, as I understand, let's say you have a link to another page on your site. Just say contact.html. Is that what you're saying versus
HTTP? No, that's just a link to another page. I'm talking about kind of image source. You know,
okay, off-site request for an image.
Well, not necessarily off-site, but off-page. It's, you know, it's not part of the HTML page. It's an external, say, a JavaScript file, an external JavaScript file.
Oh, okay.
If you put say, 5-10 JavaScript, external JavaScript files in the head of your document, the browser has to wait to load all those before it displays the body content.
Yeah.
So there's a number of things that you can do to reduce that.
Well, and also big fat graphics on your site can also have a dramatic impact, as well as, you know, if you optimize those, it can have a positive impact.
Right, right. That's probably the second. That's a good point. That's probably the second thing, big fat graphics.
Right. And there's a lot of them still out there.
Oh, there really are. Yeah. I saw one site. Basically, it looks like what they did is they took the image from a digital camera and directly uploaded. They didn't do anything to them. Just directly uploaded them.
1 megabyte photograph, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I actually have a limit. I have a little gizmo on my website that it's a free web page analyzer.
Yeah.
That tells people, it kind of analyzes the different sizes for the different components, and it tells you how large the page. I have a limit on that, and this page went way over that limit.
Oh, people are testing it. Now, where did we find that little measuring tool?
I actually recently got a domain name for it, so I don't have to give you a long URL. It's just webpageanalyzer.com.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's great.
Yeah, it's completely free, getting great feedback on it. If you have any suggestions, let us know, and we'll see if we can roll it into the next version.
You mentioned images, and I just want to say that folks out there, it doesn't count that the image that's a 1 megabyte image, if you shrink it to, you know, down as far as its dimensions, because if it's still a big image, it's still going to take a download time, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So you have to actually run it through a software program to actually filter out colors, and it's more complicated, and that's probably why a lot of people don't do it, is because it requires them to having some skill at using a graphics program.
Yeah, and there's some good ones, and there's some really good ones out there. Actually, ImageReady, I was surprised. I compared it against a number of different programs. Mm-hmm. And for JPEGs, it's very good. It's very good. They've got that thing tweaked pretty good. For GIF, it's another story. There's a lot of plugins out there that are very good at optimizing GIFs and, you know, minimizing the artifacts and the banding. So I actually wrote a couple articles about that on Web Reference that you can take a look at.
You know, Andy, you mentioned Web Reference. For a guy that is all about sharing information for free, you know, the web is all about free sharing of knowledge, right?
Yeah.
You founded webreference.com, javascript.com, so much information that you've given out there. What has been your experience of people coming to your site, taking that information, and do you ever kind of factor in, well, you know, if I was paid for everybody that used that information, I'd be richer than Bill Gates. I mean, how do you justify?
I'd be richer than Bill Gates, but that's kind of the I kind of adopted, you know, the internet ethos. The internet's been very good to me. I'm trying to be good to the internet, you know, just give out the information, and I also think that's a good way to kind of get the word out and, you know, get your name out there. But it seems to work, you know, that if say I required an ID and a password to log into Web Reference, well, I don't think we'd have nearly the traffic that we do now. So I'm just kind of adopting that approach on, well, writing a book. You know, I wrote the book to give that kind of information away. Mm-hmm. And also the website optimization site kind of took the book and summarized it. It's all on there, all the different links to different the resources that I cite. And the same idea, I guess, is behind that web page analyzer. I thought, you know, if I'm Joe User out there, Joe Webmaster, what would I want the most? And so I thought this would be it.
You can also improve your search engine results, too, by actually optimizing your site. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Website optimization, that phrase, is a really popular search term, and it means a couple of things. To me, it's like an umbrella term where it's optimizing your website, whatever you have to do to optimize your website, speed, search engine. But some people think that it means search engine optimization. So what I did is I...
Two different things.
Yeah, so I included a couple chapters in the book about that. I actually let you look over my shoulder as I optimize the keywords to the companion site to the book.
Oh, that's nice.
So I thought that would be fun. So I just went through it and just did it how I would have done it, and wrote a chapter on that. It talks about how you come up with a list of terms and refine them down to a series of steps. So it's real concrete. The whole book's like that. It's, you know, here's a page before, here's a page after, here's what you should do, here's the reasons why. And then I have another. I kind of had fun in the case study chapters. I would show like a maybe a not so good site and a really good site, mm-hmm. and pick them apart. So I have a site in there, and in one of the chapters, the second search engine chapter, that I show, well, here's what they're doing wrong. And then I show another site, actually one of the search engine optimization firms, iProspect, and I show all the things that they're doing right. So
that's good. They better do it right.
Yeah, that's right. They're experts at that.
Actually, have you heard back from anybody who've you've put in the not so good category?
No, I haven't heard back from those folks. I have heard back from Frederick Marchini. He was the CEO of the firm, and he was very happy with the coverage. Yeah. Of course, I mean, because it's a positive review, but he actually was very helpful. I talked to him. I talked to Danny Sullivan. I talked to a number of folks when I was writing those chapters. That's the other thing. That's the beautiful thing about writing a book about the Internet. You can just email practically anybody, and you tell them you're writing a book, even if you're writing a newsletter, and they're just open. They give you your time. It's kind of a reciprocal thing.
Oh, it's just like what we're experiencing with you. You're sharing so much information, and we really appreciate that.
Sure. Andy, you're welcome.
Be sure and give us now, right now, all the information, all the websites we can go to, including the website that supports the book.
Okay.
There's a lot of them, I'll bet.
Yeah. Well, websiteoptimization is .com. That's the companion site for the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually... it's also a consulting firm that I started based on the book.
And there's where you can support Andy, folks.
Yeah, that's right.
If you want to support Andy, yeah, write your name on a $20 bill. and then, let's see, Web Page Analyzer, we mentioned that before.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's actually a subdirectory of the website optimization site. There's webreference.com. That's the site that I founded. I still write the newsletter for that, actually. And javascript.com, you can go there for JavaScript information.
Perfect.
So those are the main sites. I'm kind of hesitating. I'm starting a new site, if that wasn't enough.
Oh, great.
I'm starting a new site on, it's called Optimization Week.
Oh, yeah. Really? Terrific.
Yeah, I haven't launched it yet, but I might as well tell you guys. It's going to be a weekly, I'm actually thinking of doing a daily blog, but it's going to be a weekly kind of highlight of what's going out there in the optimization industry. So I was going to launch that. It's going to be a kind of a news magazine.
Well, everybody's listening to this interview on demand 3 months from now. Definitely go check out. Now the URL will be
optimizationweek.com.
That's it.
Oh, that's a terrific one.
We'll keep
a
checking
terrific
it.
Domain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was surprised that was available.
Yeah, I was going to say most of those good ones are already taken.
Right. I was thinking Information Week, and let's see if it was available. I couldn't believe it.
Snap it up.
Terrific. Well, Andy, thank you for joining us on the show. It was great speaking with you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
I appreciate it. And you have a great weekend.
Okay, you too.
Thank you very much for listening to Web Talk Guys this week. That's it for our show this week. But Rob and I will be back here bringing you more glimpses into the future of the Internet.
Thank you for downloading the Web Talk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys channel.